hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Hello, and welcome back to the Doctor Who Commentary Podcast. We are Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, and I'm Dan. My co-host tonight is Joe, and we are discussing episode 4 of Paradise Towers.
Build high for happiness.
Ice hot.
Are you a cowardly cutlet?
I'd like...
No, I wasn't expecting you to pause.
I'd like to think I'm not, but I probably am.
I think you're ice hot. Oh, man, I love the dialogue of this. I do. Do you know, I remember watching... I remember seeing online the Doctor Who magazine poll, you know, where you put like a score behind every single story, yeah? And the editor at the time... Not the editor who's doing it now, who, may I say, appears on every fucking... But I mean, what a vanity project Doctor Who magazine is now.
There's I've never seen this before, but there's a Doctor Who event in Derby, in the summer.
And please don't tell me. Please don't tell me what I think you're going to say.
One of the guests is the current editor of Doctor Who.
Wow. I mean, did you see that thing of him on his toilet? Advertising the latest issue.
No.
Yeah, he tweeted out a video of himself on the loo, flicking through the magazine, going, oh, the latest issue of Doctor Who magazine. Not enough pictures of me, but we have this and that. And I thought, don't hang a lantern on the fact that you are on a mad, egocentric trip. Oh, what a man. Jesus. Anyway, sorry, that wasn't the point. What was I trying to say? Oh, yeah. Anyway, the editor of the magazine at the time... posted a picture in the magazine of his scores for Paradise Towers. And he said, okay. And I'm only doing this because I wanted everyone to know I'm giving Paradise Towers 10 out of 10 because it's the best Doctor Who story ever. So I do think this story has its champions.
Yes. Yeah. No, because that's the thing. Like, I suppose my first small group of Doctor Who friends on Twitter was Luke Monroy and the sort of the regular contributors to that podcast, and I know, so it's a group of like what, four or five of us, and I would say there's at least four of us that love Paradise Towers.
Oh, yeah, and I think you're right when you said earlier that the tide's turning as well. Yeah. And I think with the advent of the Blu-ray that came out, everyone's so excited when those Blu-rays come out that even when a derided season like this came out, they were like, my God, you know, I've got to post my picture of the Blu-ray arriving just to make everyone else jealous that they haven't got theirs. Yeah, I'm calling that out as well. That's absolute. Do you do it?
I used to, but I don't anymore because I can see that it's not me. I'm not that kind of person to go look at me up like this. I don't think you are. But I kind of just got carried away on that crest of a wave. Everyone else is doing it, so I should do
it. It's the latest fad, yeah. Now I just scroll and I go, if I see one more fucking picture of that Blu-ray set, you know, even though mine's already arrived, I'm like, I don't need to know that you've got some post. Jesus. You know, you don't put up pictures of your tax returns, do you?
No.
Was I making a point? I was just ranting about things. Paradise Towers.
Oh, yeah, the editor. Yeah.
Okay, well, then I am going to throw a question at you before we go into four. And that is, do you think, because I haven't got to ask you this yet because it's the first commentary we've done, do you think four parts is the ideal length for a Doctor Who story? A classic Doctor Who story.
Yes, because I would stand by a statement that quite a few people have made where they feel that six parts doesn't work. It's always too long, and it goes a bit flabby, a bit flat in the middle maybe. So there were quite a few six-parters I struggle with. Two-parters, I mean, they never seem substantial enough. Because it's we've and they're all been quite weird stories, haven't they? You know, when you got the well, I can't remember the first one. What was it? Edge of Destruction, isn't it? And then you've got the rescue. So Edge of Destruction is this weird, mad fever dream of a story, isn't it? Rescue is basically introducing the new companion. Then we don't. Well, I suppose then we don't get them until, was it Sontaran
Sontaran
Experiment?
experiment, yeah.
Which I personally, I really, really love. I love that one.
But that's kind of a six-parter, isn't it? It's that an arc in space. It's set in the same universe.
Well, I think that season feels like you could kind of watch it in one big
Yeah,
long
for
thing, isn't
sure.
it? They're really well linked together. You know, the fact that the second one's set on Nerva Beacon, but you come back to that at the end in Revenge of the Cybermen, don't you?
You know, Dan, nobody has done Sontaran experiment yet for Hamps of a Blunt Penknife. We'll
Put me
talk.
up. Put me up.
Right, hang on. I'll just do this is very indulgent. I'll just do the diary. Okay, yeah, right, you're in.
So yeah, and like all those Davison ones, they're I mean, like King's Demons is one of my least favorite Doctor Who's.
Oh,
So
sure.
boring.
I've got to do season 20 soon, and yeah, that's going to
Yeah.
be a toughie to talk about. They're so insubstantial, aren't
Yeah, I'm not sure why they became a regular thing during that era, but I mean, Black Orchid's okay, but again, nothing really happens. The Doctor just plays cricket, and Adric stuffs his face at the party. The Awakening, I quite like that one, but yeah, I feel yeah, four episodes. This is a very long-winded answer to your
No,
question.
go on.
Yeah, I think two's too short, six is too long. Threes sometimes work, but I think more often or not, you kind of wish there was a fourth part to kind of make it work better. I understand why they did them. It was, JNT trying to stretch the budget as far as he could, and he did a wonderful job at doing that. But yeah, I
It's a
think.
weird trade-off with Freeze because I feel like they go by so fast. Like they're so easy to watch and they're super fast-paced and it's over before you know it. When I did Delta recently, we couldn't believe how fast it went by. But on the other hand, like you said earlier, there's so much missing sometimes that it hampers the storytelling.
Yeah, I think for me, Delta is probably the one that works the best because, like we were saying earlier, that question from one of your, was it from Fraser? Was it? I can't remember who it was now, but yeah, it's got a nice pace to it that works really well with that story and the story they're trying to tell. Whereas then I think like when you look at like Ghostlight, it would be nice to have a fourth one kind of. Let it breathe better.
Survival, I think. Survival works well as free.
Yeah, because I think once they get off the cheetah planet, the story's almost told, isn't it? And
They basically do, don't they? On Earth, on the cheetah planet, and then mostly on Earth again. It's sort of
yeah,
structured
with
that
motor,
way.
which is
We're, oh, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. Coming
yes.
soon to Strictly Come Hamster.
But yeah, I think four is ideal, for me personally.
I don't think the problem with a four is sometimes the three is running on the spot because we can't conclude the story yet. So you do get your
Yeah.
maximum corridor wandering or location running around or.
Yeah, I hear that, and I because I think like you kind of get that with all the six parties. I mean, even like Genesis of the Daleks, which is regarded as a classic, there's a lot of like trekking to and from the two cities, isn't there? And it's kind of they're just filling time, and you think, well, maybe if they had gone five or even a four, that would work so much better.
Two of the fives, Mind Robber and Demons, I think work beautifully as fives. They afford extra time for, well, one is sort of conceptual madness, just extended set pieces, and the other one, the demons, just affords lots of character moments with its extra time. Circling around to Paradise Towers, I do think this is a perfectly structured four-parter. I don't think it runs out of incident. I think the mystery is maintained long enough. I feel like the answers come when they need to be. And then in the last episode, it's so satisfying because it is literally the individual plot elements, i.e. the Rezzies, the Kangs, all of that, joining forces to create the by now established villain. Stephen White's written a great script here, I think. And, you know, I did say on Strictly that the one thing that is missing from season 26 is a third Stephen White script. Because I think Paradise Towers is a great script. I think Greatest Showman in the Galaxy is a great script. And I think there's space for it because I think he's developing.
I mean, it's yes, yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? But I mean, I think that's the unfortunate thing about this era, isn't it? The fact that they only got four stories a year, that because there are so, is it Malcolm Cole that that did the Delta and the Bannerman? I would have liked to have seen a second one from him. What could he?
Graham Curry, the Happiness Patrol, what would he have done next? Most get two, don't they? Ian Briggs gets two, Ben Aronovich gets two. Mark Platt, unfortunately, only got one. I'd like to have seen a second one, but he would have had two had they done another season. But as well, because in 26, sorry guys, I promise you we'll get to the episode in a minute. In 26, it is very serious for the most part. Battlefield's fun, but it is trying to tell a serious story. It's just the fact that I don't think the director got the note that it's as fun as it is. And I feel like that sort of quirky writing that Wyatt does would have alleviated that. The trouble is you've got those three ace stories there, which is doing past, present, and future, and you don't really want to cut that up. So you'd have to lose Battlefield, and I wouldn't want to lose Battlefield for anything because it's
No.
so ridiculously enjoyable.
I love Battlefield.
So what I want is a fifth story in season 26, and I want to see what sort of dark, funny, smart thing Wyatt would have done after Greatest Showman in the Galaxy, because I think he's a massively promising writer.
I think that was one of the greatest strengths of this era, is that I don't know how he did it, but Cartmell was able to find these writers that should have had much more promising, but their careers should have been bigger than what they actually got in the end. Unfortunately, I don't know whether it was being associated with Doctor Who at that time tarnished
Oh,
and
crikey, I hope not.
hindered their careers because of the way the BBC was just like, we want to kill this. We don't want it anymore. But he found all it and then gave them the environment to be able to go create and which
Tell
sometimes
whatever story you want to tell. Imagine telling a writer that. Wow. Okay.
And go off and read this and this for influences.
And then JNT gets, what the hell is this? Do you remember when he got the Delta script? He said it was the worst thing he's ever read. Sometimes he's a little out of touch.
But I would have thought he would have loved that, all of the 1950s, all the singing
He
and
was down to direct that as well. I think he wanted to direct it, but he was too busy chasing after Doctor Who fans or something to actually do that. But
I wonder what he would have been like as a director as well. I mean, because
he
there's little
directed
bits.
the Cyber Massacre scene in
Five,
Five
Five
Doctors.
Doctors, which is awesome.
I think he probably would have been very good, but we'll never know now, will we?
No, we won't.
Maybe he should have directed to Curtis Fenwick. Oh, sorry. Okay,
We
well, shall we skip on into episode four?
better way.
People are getting good value for money out of us today, though, even though they ain't paying nothing. Right. Okay. What do you want to count us in?
Oh yeah, okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
Bosh, off we go. Now we need to have the big Richard Briers as Croagnon conversation. What do you imagine he's channeling here?
Oh, God knows. I mean, it's on like anything that he's ever done in his career, isn't it, really? When you think of, you know, like Monarch of the Glen and all that kind of stuff and The Good Life.
Have you ever, like, really needed a poo, but you couldn't go?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think everyone's been through that. That's sort of how he walks around, isn't it? You know, sort of like when you really need to go, oh!
but that what is it? Flesh. Living flesh. That's just so great.
Was it? We'll be back to collect the rubbish later. Now, my defense of this is, well, we don't know that Croagnon was a person, right? We don't know that he was a humanoid. He could have been an alien or anything. He could have been one of those weird purple creatures from Delta and the Bannermen.
The Marino, yeah.
But all we know is for years and years and years, he's been this disembodied, you know, voice inside that box of tricks with eyes for some reason. And now he's found himself in a humanoid body that he doesn't really know how to control. So there is a sort of weird, twitchy, I'm not sure what I'm doing with this body. And it looks like an actor who's not sure what he's doing with the performance. But if you kind of give it that reading of like, he's puppeteering this body, but he doesn't quite know what to do with it.
Yeah, no, because I get that as well, because like he is basically controlling a corpse, isn't he? So obviously, you know, rigor mortis would be kind of setting in, and you know, because judging by the color of his face now is that sort of gray kind of I've been dead for a long time look. So it would be very stiff and not.
What's unfortunate is how he delivers the dialogue.
Yes, that's
which is so over the top. He makes Graham Crowden in Horns of Nymon look understated.
What about Darrow in Time Lash?
I mean, I think that's quite an understated performance within its sort of over the topness. Save your breath for the Time Lash, Dan. Most people depart with a scream. No, but when he's there going, you know, carry me away.
Yeah, because it's isn't it the bit where the doctor basically video calls him to kind of it was it, he goes at one point he just goes like that. So just
and he can underplay it at times as well, because there are a few moments where he brings his voice right down. You know, it's not long I've been walking around my wonderful towels again, he says, or something like that.
Because that's the bit when he's with Pex as well, you know, and which I think is that bit you just, where he's like, he like pulls him up at one point and goes, not frightened, are you?
Honestly, if Big Finish ever want to do the Return of Croagnon, I'm going to give him your number.
Ah, right.
Your Croagnon is on point. I don't know if it's that useful a skill, but
no, probably not. It's certainly not going to get me a BAFTA, is it?
Now let's watch how this is directed. This scene with Mel and the robots. Oh, okay, we're under the water. Yeah. He's struggling about. We can see his. Oh no, clearly he's not holding her there though. In those scenes above the water, never mind. He's just going after her.
It just looks like he's coming in for a grope, actually, doesn't it?
I mean. For all we know, he might just collect musical actresses. He's like, come on, I want your autograph. But no, she's just assuming he's trying to kill her. Yeah. Is it scary, that robot? I mean, certainly Stan thought it was.
Stan did, yeah. I mean, I think at the time I thought it was fantastic, but then...
I still do.
You can see that there are... reasons why some people would kind of hate on it.
But just for that publicity picture of the robot holding Mel's leg and McCoy trying to pull her away. Oh, it's so funny. Oh, do you know what he does as well, Cragnon? He's that shit camp villain. As he's fumigating all the floors, he's got a big pin and he draws a line on the floor. Floor 502. Wee. Oh, dear. Do you think that's a tipping point for some people then? Richard Briers in this episode.
Yeah, I think so.
Would you have sat him down like JNT and said, "Now, come on, Richard"?
Yeah, because I mean, I don't for a second believe that he was just taking the Mickey out of it, because he's too much of a professional actor to do that. But, but I can see why people would say, "Oh, he's just taking the piss here with this performance. He's not taking it seriously." But yes, I can understand. I personally would have done the same. But I mean, did J&T sitting down with him have any effect? Or is this toned down version?
No, he actually says in an interview, no, he just made him dig his heels in even more.
Ah, right, okay.
Like a naughty schoolboy. You think I'm over the top, do you? You ain't seen nothing yet. That bit there where the chief caretaker, or Cragnon, sorry, was walking and the cleaner's literally pumping out toxic smoke and the caretaker's like coughing, and if he weren't talking, that scene would be great.
Yeah.
He's literally just going around murdering everybody.
It's quite horrific, isn't it? Because there's this guy that was their boss, basically, just killing them all off.
There is a version of this that would be like a 15.
Yeah, for sure.
So maybe you do need the camp and the humour to keep it Doctor Who.
To balance it, yeah. Because I was thinking about this bit here where the Kangs are bullying Pex. Because I went through a little period where when I went from infant school to junior school, where I was kind of bullied. And I can imagine for kids that were in that position, watching that is quite triggering, I would have thought.
Well, then I suppose it's nice that you've got Bonnie there then stepping up and looking out for him.
Defending those that need defending.
The payoff for it, of course, is when he is a cowardly cutler, but when he sacrificed himself, he's like, okay, I've got to do this, is how much respect they have for him.
Yeah.
I mean, it costs his life to get there.
Yeah.
But weirdly enough, the final shot I find really moving when the TARDIS dematerializes and it goes in on Pex lives.
And also that what's the line? Is it something along the lines of, in life he wasn't a Kang, but in death he behaved as a Kang should do. And that's just really nice, that total turnaround. You know, and obviously that's his story, isn't it? But
what do you reckon Maddie said then when we cut away? Yes, I'm so sorry I ate your best friend as a stew, but we do need your help.
I only ate the yellow ones.
Yeah.
What are you worried about?
Yeah, we never touched the red and blue ones. No. The lower classes, that's what we went for. You wouldn't miss them. Oh no, look, Bryce is giving it some eye now, isn't he? Unless and the deputy chief caretaker might be cottoning on to the fact that he's behaving in an unusual fashion.
Do you think? It's just like,
watch how he skips over the cleaner. Oh, bless. Yeah, I mean, this is Panto now, right?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't, I'll go to the Panto every year. If Cragnon turned up on the screen and everyone went boo, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
But I think it's not just Richard Briers, is it? I think there's something quite Panto about the Rezzies chucking their tablecloths over the cleaners, and then the Kang shooting them with their bow and arrows. It's just
and she goes, "Come on to the next one." Doesn't she?
And there's like these old women going in the background.
Can I also? I mean, take a good look at those Rezzies. Why are they dolled up like prozzies? I mean, they've got that's a lot of slap on their faces, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, like Maddie there. I mean, it's the eyeshadow is like it's weird goldy apricot color, isn't it? It's like
the woman on the left has got the biggest necklace I've seen outside of Pat Butcher and EastEnders.
That is quite
look at it, enormous. I mean, they're off to murder somebody. They're not going to a tea party. Oh, we better look our best for them, you know.
They are definitely wearing their Sunday best, aren't they?
Oh, God, one of those blue Kangs. Check out the wigs. It is a very unfortunate fitting. Look, the one at the back there. Oh, no, not her. Where's she gone? Oh, I'll tell you when she's back in shot again. Mind you, the Kangs are wearing a bit of makeup too for sort of rough street girls.
Yeah.
I mean, they've had a bit of a tutorial on the space tube.
Well, yeah, or one of the Rezzies must have been like, this is how you do it.
Actually, maybe that was between scenes where we cut away. Look at her in the back there. Look at that wig. It's terrible. Oh, here he comes. Here's your favourite, Clive Merrison. I'm sorry to intrude like this. I wonder if I can have a word with you all.
Oh, yeah, here it is.
I'm going to try doing this at work as the delivery's being worked. Get my big red pen, right? That one's done. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Maybe that is, maybe it's too literal an interpretation of what's occurring.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. I do always think you should keep one eye on the kids watching. Like, a lot of the time when Doctor Who talks down to its audience, I wonder if it's explaining to the kids watching. Because if I was, like, 5 watching this, would I really understand what's going on? No, but would I understand if I saw that big diagram of a building and a lion going through a floor? Yes.
Yeah. I'm still looking out for the actress from Parting of the Wave.
Apparently she is in there somewhere. I don't think it's that one there now. Oh my word, she looks very perturbed, doesn't she?
Fine.
Iceheart, yes, we can blow the cleaners, no problem. Send the cleaners to the cleaners.
Classic.
Oh no.
And here we go. Tablecloths over them.
We'll see if that works, shall we, in like a real war.
Yeah. Yeah.
Throw your tablecloth over a tank, guys. Let's see what happens. Oh, is this where the doctor rings him up? Ah, Cragnon, hello. I've never seen such shoddy workmanship in all my life. I believe this was written before McCoy was cast.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think Delta was the first script written with McCoy in mind.
Right.
So given this was sort of generically characterised, it suits him really well.
It does, yeah.
Actually, do you know what? It would work on me as well. If you called me up and went, hello, Joe. That's the most shoddy podcast I've ever seen in my life. Come along to this meeting and get some tips. I'd be like, off and straight there. What's that? You sent Luke Malloy to guide me. Fine, I'm coming. He's not a cowardly cutlet.
No, for sure.
Actually, Luke, he's been heroic. I've got no choice, Mel. He goes.
One thing is his hat in this season as well. It's kind of
wonky.
Yeah, and battered and more sort of dog-eared, isn't it, in this one? Whereas the next couple of seasons, it's kind of a bit more.
When he gets that sort of tailored brown jacket in the last season,
it's almost like he's just bought it, you know, kind of thing. It's, you know, he's
It's sort of, he has to get that suit after he destroys Scarrow. You know, he's like, come on now. I'm a professional now.
Oh, and don't forget the Cybermen as well. He does exactly the same to the Cybermen.
Just as you nailed the Daleks. That's right. I can't believe they do that.
Oh no, it wouldn't happen nowadays at all, would it? You know that, you know, because you've had certain stories moved from certain series to because they're too similar. So, but yeah, in this, it's sort of like we just retell the same story with the Cybermen.
And we'll point it out as well.
Yeah,
Like, Bonnie, I love you, but please, love, will you tone it down a bit? She was just like, but if you go out there, Doctor, you'll be killed. Come on now. I see what you mean. Yeah, there is something a bit shambolic about him, isn't there? But is it that sort of Troughton thing of don't underestimate him? He might look like a little tramp, but actually.
I think, yeah, it seems like that was kind of what they were going for in this one, wasn't it? That I want to say Charlie Chaplin, but I don't know if that's necessarily correct. But you know, that kind of trampish sort of look.
I've heard that actually. You pointed that McCoy and Trout, and that Chaplin-esque, that description. And it's because they're both a bit bumbling as well, so you underestimate them, and then before you know it, your planet's destroyed or whatever, you know, the government's toppled. Oh, they blow up good, don't they? In fact, the McCoy era does love an explosion. They go crazy in Remembrance of the Daleks.
Was it because it didn't like the police rock up because it set off all the alarms for like miles around?
Oh, you're filming Doctor Who. We thought it was a terror attack. Nowadays, they'd all be arrested. Central London.
Oh, big time.
Oh, Pex, I've been asked to give you this, a Kang bracelet. And then they're all looking on, sort of proud of him. And he still balls it up.
I like that bit in a minute where he's talking to the great architect because he knows where the doctor is, and he I think he delivers it really well because he's sort of like was it goes something along the lines of all the other mobile garbage like that sort of, but the way he delivers it is really good, like he's trying to think of the right
In a
words.
way that will please him. Yeah. Oh my God, even one of the caretakers was bopping around then. Yay! Oh dear, how things have changed in Paradise Towers. Come on, Pex. Flex those muscles on the screen there.
It's the arms folded always makes your muscles look a little bit bigger, don't it?
Oh man, I take pictures like that all the time. Yeah. People swoon, you know? No, they don't. They don't. So let me get this straight. The way they're attempting to defeat Groagnon is to lure him to this door and push him through it and down a ruddy great hole to his death. It's not the usual way you dispatch a villain in Doctor Who, is it? Very Looney Tunes.
And it doesn't feel very Sylvester McCoy, Seventh Doctor, as we've come to love him. It
No.
doesn't feel, you know, clever enough, does it?
Come season 26, he's literally got the solution prepared before the story's even started. He's just sort of acting all the way through. Oh, God, how are we going to get out of this? I had it planned all along. Oh, no, look at what his bride's doing now. Not frightened, are you?
Oh, he's
Oh,
bottling it. He's bottling it.
what's it called? I keep asking people this. I should just look it up. When the music reflects movement in the story. So there's a bit in a minute where the can goes duh, 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 and the music follows every hand movement. Is that diegetic? Is that what it's called? When the music
I haven't
informs
got
the
a clue.
action.
That's too highbrow for me.
Okay, well, keep talking. I'll quickly look it up.
It's, I mean, again, this is we're getting to see the largeness of the set because we've got that bridge and the layers, and all of the scale of it. It's just fantastic, really. That they could, were able to do this on a 1980s budget.
When, what is it, $1 million a season they were getting at this point, which was piss poor. No, diegetic means occurring within the context of the story and able to be heard by the characters. Well, I'll never know then, will I?
Okay.
Oh, here we go. Cragnon is marching like a lunatic now.
Yeah, he's not quite so stiff there, is he? He's quite sprightly. Oh,
beg your pardon. I wanted to have a few words with you. Oh, yeah. Yeah, look at this shoddy podcast I found myself in tonight. Yeah, that's what you should be saying to me. Yeah, actually, look at the state of that wall.
Yeah.
They have gone to town on making it sort of run down, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
this is so funny. Just to push him down, and then in the most exaggerated hit ever.
It's that bit in the minute, though, where he grabs Sylvester by the scruff of his shirt and like he's like bashing him up against the wall.
There we go. It's like... What is he doing? Look, he's still doing it while Pex is making his decision. Oh, no, come on. Come 26, they wouldn't be doing that, would they?
No.
That was so panto. And then he looks
at the... He's like, what's this?
this
expression on his face is just class.
God almighty, you can't take a bit of it seriously, but it is fucking delirious, isn't it? Oh, no, hang on, wait, this is quite moving.
It's quite touching, yeah, yeah.
Brave and bold as a Dan should be. One of those Rezzies is wearing a sort of Last of the Summer Wine pinafore. What a bunch of cats. I mean, what is going to happen here when he goes? Well, you're going to tell me.
Well, yeah, I'll read that comic strip and I'll let you know.
How will they build a society? Who's going to be shagging? Rezzies and the caretakers, I hope.
It does beg a question of like, yeah, how do they repopulate the tower?
It should end, right, with McCoy going, here's the front door. It was just covered by a bit of debris. You know,
go, you're free.
Yeah. Actually, that would have been nice. Imagine them all walking out into the light, you know? Like,
yeah, and all, yeah, sort of blinking in the sunlight.
Into society. Yeah, a bit like the Truman Show ending, you know?
Yeah, like those two lads in The Mysterious Planet where they come out of the ways and they're going...
Gorgeous,
you know,
yeah.
Up until that point, they've been absolute dickheads, you know, but then they come out and they're going, oh, do you know what? You're right, that's beautiful. You know?
What does he say? It's fresh air.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that bit. We've made you an honorary Kang Doctor. Which one? Both. Then I'd be honoured to wear it. Or would you think about McCoy's business with his hat, whatever that thing is, in front of the TARDIS?
I can only imagine it's him ad-libbing. I don't think that was in the script. I think it's just him going, oh, wouldn't it be, you know, amusing to...
Apparently, Danny was notorious for this.
Oh, yeah. I don't doubt it. I mean, I'm surprised he hasn't whipped out his spoons and started...
Give it time. Yeah, I used to say to him, look, the rehearsals, got that plenty of time, be as creative as you want. All your suggestions, throw them in. Lovely. When we get to the studio, we need to film.
Hmm.
Yes, of course. Yes, don't worry. Right, lights, action. Wouldn't it be wonderful if... No, Sylvester, shut up! Apparently, he was notorious on the set for this.
I can kind of... see why, because of like his background, where it was like the Ken Campbell thing, which just sounds like chaos on a stage. I can imagine that's
great.
Yeah. You know, with the ferrets down the trousers and the nails up the nose and what have you. I can kind of understand why he would go, oh yeah, this we could do this. And it must have, I mean, I think like JNT and Andrew Cartmell must have wanted to give him his, you know, give him a bit of leeway so that he can do the role as he wants to do it. But there must have been, on the flip side, they must have gone, come on, Sylvester, we need to kind of, you know, you can't quite do that. But I don't know. I don't know.
But I've got to say, there's so much business in the McCoy years. There's so many little moments, the nose touching, you know, the umbrella in Silver Nemesis, all of those little touches. I think it's worth the director being a little bit impatient to get all of those charming moments in there. And I think it's always for the good of the production. He just wants to take it up above how good it already is, you know? I think he's totally invested.
Oh yeah, you can tell even now he loves being the Doctor and at this point being you know having been the Doctor.
What's that line he gives? I began to realise what a gift of a part this was, and all the different places I could take it. And I never thought I'd say this in a million years, 10 years ago. I just think we were so lucky to have him. We're still lucky to have him, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, it's sort of like the casting decision to bring him in, you know, as the Doctor. Because I mean, who would have known who Sylvester McCoy is? I mean, it's only because he's the Doctor and I've looked at what he did before that I know that he was in stuff like the Ken Campbell Roadshow, but I didn't know what the hell that was as a kid. He was in, what was it? There was a sort of, is it Vision On? But again, I don't think I was aware of that, you know.
I don't think there's been such a dramatic turnaround with any actor, though, because this is the guy that Ian Levine roped into recording a pre-title sequence to downtime on no money at all. Yeah. He went from that to appearing in The Hobbit in the space of 15 years. And in those terms, he's technically had the most successful career of all of the Doctors, because that film made more money than everything all the others did put together.
And what was it? Was it King Lear, wasn't it? He played the fool in that. And that was meant, that's been lauded as being
hugely praised. Yeah. And then it's gone on to do other movies as well, The Munsters recently and things like that. Turned up in Sense8 over in America. You know, he's had, and at the same time, he's still doing, you know, big finishes for Sixpence.
Yeah.
He's an incredible man.
Pretty much every convention going as well.
Yeah, well, I hear, this is a rumor that I was told by the usual suspect, that he was one of the first people to become a millionaire out of the convention circuit because he'd been in The Hobbit, because he'd been in Doctor Who. He was invited to everything.
Yeah.
And he could charge a fortune for those Hobbit photo shoots and things like that. He's a savvy bloke.
Well, I must admit that how many times have I met him now? I think I've met him a couple of times at various conventions. And the most of the conventions I go to are like those all-inclusive ones. But then there's bonus guests where you have to kind of pay on the day to meet them. And he's always one of the bonus guests, which is slightly more money for his autograph. But even like, I mean, like £25, I think it is not... It's not a great deal of money, like you say, considering what he's been in since.
It's not for your moment with him as well, you know, for your couple of minutes with him.
I think like the last time I saw him, George, my son came with me because Sylvester's his favourite classic Doctor, and because he was like I say, a bonus guest, not many people were going up to meet him, but George had never met him before. So I thought, yeah, my favorite Doctor, I want to see him again, you know. And we were there for ages. He was like, because George took one of those, the Doctor Who magazine now are doing those like, where they take a year and they do a... They're really, really good. On like the monthly magazine, but don't get me started on that. George took the 1988 one there, and Sylvester was going, "Oh, what's this? I've never seen this before." And he was just there flicking through it, and he would come across a picture, a photograph in there, and he would go, "Oh yeah," and then tell us some anecdote about that story, and then he would ask our opinion on it. You know, like, what did you think of the Candyman in Happiness Patrol and all this sort of thing. It was really, really nice, especially as it was like George's first kind of doctor and first experience of it. But yeah, a lovely man.
I've heard some mixed stories about pretty much every Doctor Who actor. I've never heard an anecdote about McCoy that wasn't, he gave me all of his attention and he gave me my moment and made me feel really special and was quirky and everything I wanted him to be. So we've got to do our three fabulous reasons as to why we recommend Paradise Towers, but let's end our discussion on Paradise Towers by just saying, as you just said there, what a guy. And for whatever I might say about his dreadful shouting acting, what a talent, you know.
For sure. And like you say, we as Doctor Who fans are really lucky that we got someone like Sylvester at this point in the show.
If only the BBC knew that as well. Bastards.
We want that, we want that fourth season with McCoy. Hello,
Yeah.
what do you think of the Big Finish version? Because
Oh,
I
don't
didn't
get me
like it. I
started.
didn't like it.
Remember that story I told you earlier about me and having a run-in with someone for Big Finish?
Oh, was that
It
what it
was
was about?
about one of those.
Ooh.
I was not impressed.
No, because I think it for me, it started reasonably okay with the Ice Warrior one. I kind of liked that one. But then it didn't get much better from there on in.
I thought the worst one was the Aronovich Earth Aid, the last one with the comedy aliens. That was just diabolical. The best one I thought was the Angela Bruce one, Animal. And even that I thought was pretty average. So as a whole, I don't believe for a second what was in those audios is what would have made it to the screen. I think it's them coming back to it later, discussing it and
Oh, yeah, because this Cardinal Master Plan that's often talked about wasn't
Wasn't there at
anything.
all.
It
No.
wasn't, no, and then all of a sudden it's this big, massive, leading up to Lung Barrow,
I mean, I do just happen to have a key on my keyboard here that says Numlock, and that's the name of one of the monsters in one of those stories. That's how much imagination is going into those.
Tell me, Andrew Cartmell, where did you get your inspiration from?
I think what would have made it to the screen in 1990. Oh, what a thought, 1990 would have been season 26 done again, maybe even a little more polished, and even better, but we'll never know.
Never know.
So another one of those what
No.
ifs. Well, look, let's do our three reasons why. I mean, we've covered a lot, but we've got to sort of boil it down now. You go first, then me, and then back to you again.
I think my number one, and I think I'm a sucker for visuals and that sort of creativity, but it is, when we've talked about it quite a bit, both of us, the set is just brilliant, I think from the point of view that we've talked about scale and we've talked about different levels. It's got all of that, and some Doctor Who sets of that time did have that. I'm not saying this is an isolated incident, but the fact that they've kind of like gone, right, okay, so this is something that was once, beautiful, but it's seen better days, but now it's all run down and grubby, and they've got the lighting right, even to the like you've got. You go through different characters and one of them's green, or you go for another one and the lighting's red, it's just, I just love it. I just think it's one of the best parts of the entire story, and we didn't see that terribly often, I don't think, during the classic years of Doctor Who. I'm not just saying the 80s, but from 63 on to 89.
Think of the studio band stories of the McCoy era. There's only one in the studio story that did it even better, and that's Ghostlight. That house is just gorgeous. But look at the Happiness Patrol. It doesn't always work. So look at that, and then look at this. And I think this is doing a sterling job.
Really good, really good.
I want to praise Stephen Wyatt, who literally comes into Doctor Who full of ideas. No real idea who's playing the Doctor. and just belts out a tight, funny, clever, weird Doctor Who script that is pushing the show in a brand new direction, ditching continuity completely. There's not one reference in this. Fucking refreshing after all those years of continuity and looking back at the past. Suddenly we're forging ahead into the future. Absolutely packed full of great lines. And I think on paper, episode 4 is very satisfying. I don't know if it hits the screen because there's some weird choices made, but as a script, I think it is near perfect. I actually think it's a better script than Greatest Show in the Galaxy, but Greatest Show has got a better production.
Yes. Oh, yeah, quite agree. Yeah, about the continuity, at what point did they ditch Ian Levine? Because he was this continuity.
No, Ian Levine stepped away when Bonnie Langford was cast.
Right.
And said he refused to have anything to do with Doctor Who if she was in it. And look, all of a sudden the show starts improving.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder why.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, because I mean, that's, you know, because listening to you guys do Strictly about Colin's first season, and a Man Alive, Attack of the Cybermen is just fan wank, isn't it? All the way through. And it's not even correct a lot of the time. It's not, it's wrong.
Yeah, it's madness. That's what happens when you write Doctor Who for Ian Levine.
Yeah.
And you know, like, I'm gonna be disingenuous now, but I think that's what's happening in, I'm about to talk about it in a couple of weeks, series 9 of the new series. We're making Doctor Who for old fans who like Doctor Who to be serious and worthy. And not embarrassing to watch, and not camp, and not fun. And I just think it's a mistake. And just like Attack of the Cybermen, the show was on the brink of coming to an end. And just like season 22, the ratings dwindled. So it's, you know, I think it's a worthy approach. I think this is what Doctor Who should be. It should always be accessible. You should always remember the kids. You should always remember the casual audience. And joy of joys, you can also cater for Doctor Who fans as well.
Yeah, no, it's very true.
Oh, whose point was it?
That was yours, so it's me to do my.
Oh, cool. Off you go.
Yeah, I again, it's probably no surprise to anyone, but I would like to highlight Sylvester McCoy. So, you know, this is his second story. I'm not sure what order they were filmed in, but when you think of the difference in performance from Time of the Rani to this, so stories that on screen are sequential, you know, they've ditched all of that malapropisms and all that sort of stuff, which was
what a shame.
Yeah, you know, and he. You know, we've said because he was playing against this really over the top big performance from Richard Briers, it's quite a self-contained kind of one, so there's less of the pratfalls and all of the stuff that we were kind of getting in, because because I know there's a lot of this in Dragonfire, isn't there, where he's like skidding around corners. But he does it at one point in Time of the Rani, doesn't he? He's legging it down one corridor, and he's like the Looney Tunes kind of thing.
I mean, there's a little bit in this when he's attacked by the cleaners and he falls down the aisle like, but it's certainly a world away.
Yes, you know, and you can see... you know, it's almost like the butterfly coming out of the chrysalis, isn't it? Kind of, you know, that he's beginning to find his feet. I know, like for him, he says that it wasn't until 25 that he kind of knew what to do with the role. So this whole season, he is kind of finding his feet. But for me, what you see on the TV, you can see him beginning to find his feet. You can see him beginning to grow into the role. You can see him, you know, being more decisive about what he wants to do with the Doctor, and I think it's, you know, he's just brilliant. He hooked me in as a kid. Like I say, I had that little blip where I fell out of love with this era, but that, you know, there were reasons for that. And I've gone back to it, and I probably love it even more than I did back then. And a big reason for that is because of Sylvester McCoy. Yeah, I just think he's good. He's brilliant.
Man, I'm loving all the McCoy love on this. I would like to say as my second then, it's my second or my third? My second
Second.
is Richard Briers in every iteration of the chief caretaker that he plays in this. Like you said, that sort of officious, rule-bound character that we all hate. He plays that to perfection, but with a line in sort of comic wit as well that makes him really fun to watch. And then I'll say it again, once he becomes Coragnon, I think you've got a truly hissable villain that young children, and I just don't think we should forget those kids. 4-year-olds would just be like, from scene to scene, probably laughing their heads off at him because he's so crazy, and also being quite scared because he's killing people.
Yeah, no, I think that actually that is a really good point, because really it would be a much duller story if we didn't have the end of three going into four performance from Richard Briers, because at that point there's no real big villain, is there?
It would
You
be
know,
a lot
it's just.
worthier. It would be a lot, you know, you'd be able to show it to
Oh
your friends.
yeah. But then who wants Doctor Who for that?
But I think as a kid, I'd be like going, oh, he's so silly, you know. And but then he's, you know, that caretaker's falling down into the gas, and I'd be like, oh, God. You know what I mean? I just don't think, don't take your eyes off the kids.
I think you're really right there, you know, because at the end of the day, it's a program that should be accessible for all, you know, because I don't prescribe to that thing that it's a kids program. Probably that's probably why I'm really into it now as a 45-year-old. But yes, it should have a thing that appeals to the children, but it's a family show. You know, that was the brilliant thing when I first become a dad, that when George was of an age where he was kind of taking notice with these things, both my wife, myself, and my son, we sat on the sofa and we watched it every Saturday without fail. And it's because it's a family show. It should appeal to those that are fans. It should appeal to those that just like good TV, and it should appeal to the children that want to be entertained by a good fun program, you know.
I had a conversation about Heaven Sent and Hell Bent recently, where I made the argument that that just isn't for kids. You know, all that technobabble and all of that walking around a castle with an old man, like that's just not what kids want to watch. You know, being angst-ridden, and I just think that's science fiction for intellectuals. You know, and Dylan Reese, who was on there, made the argument that I don't think Doctor Who should be made for kids anymore. You know, and I just think that's an appalling attitude to take. I whether you need those kids or not to take Doctor Who into the next generation, I think there should be the next generation of young Doctor Who fans.
Yeah, because I think, like, you know, when you think of that time when Doctor Who was at its most popular. So what are we, seasons two, no, series two to four, with David Tennant as the Doctor. I mean, you couldn't go into shops without falling over action figures and toys and all that sort of stuff. I mean, we've got boxes and boxes of the stuff up in the attic that George bought when he was a little boy, you know. Yeah, you know, but there was a mass appeal to it, you
But he
know.
included like burping bins and farting
Yeah.
hangers and stupid things that kids would laugh at. And that's the stuff that older Doctor Who fans hate.
Because
it's so embarrassing. It's so humiliating. Oh, fuck off. Like, remember the kids. Am I making an argument that Paradise Towers is better Doctor Who? Doctor Who. I don't mean drama. Is it better Doctor Who than Heaven Sent? But by a mile, it is better Doctor
Well,
Who.
better be a better Doctor Who, but
I'd almost make the argument it's better telly as well because it's far more entertaining to watch. Anyway, sorry. Back to you.
I will highlight the deputy care
Yes.
caretaker played by Clive Merrison because I for me he w w so I'm not quite as on board with Richard Briers's last bit of his performance as you are, but with the deputy caretaker, I think he finds exactly where that performance should be. So there is that, there is obviously a comedy element to it, and like we highlighted it where he goes, it'd be in the rule book, like that, which is a bit over the top, it kind of breaks character a little bit there, but I don't know, I just find it so entertaining, and I just love his relationship with the chief caretaker, because he obviously he looks up to this guy and admires him, and but also I think he's a little bit crushed and downtrodden by him as well, and he plays that really really well, that the both sides of that that
It's
character.
the Iron Gron and Blood Axe. It is the what's it, Brotodak and Grugger from Megalos, the subordinate who is downtrodden but fucking hilarious because of it.
And Doctor Who's got such a rich history of those kind of double acts, and I think this feels, this Paradise Towers one feels like it's up there with some of the best. Not everyone will agree with that, I know, but that's my opinion, and I he's one of the reasons why I really enjoy Paradise Towers. Just is.
He's just a wonderful actor, Clive Merrison. I don't think I've ever seen him deliver a bad performance ever. Well, my last thing then is going to be the Rezzies, which was always my favorite part of this when I was younger. And I think it's secretly still, and one, because it's just crazy camp. These two wonderful character actresses getting to, fawn over Bonnie Langford in the way that they do, Don't be silly, dear. They are so funny until they're not, and then they're really sinister, and they're still funny. Oh, well, see if you can find the basil. Those sort of crazy lines, and then they both get dragged off by a metal claw at the fucking waste disposal chute. I mean, it's crackers, isn't it? But this is my Doctor Who. I like it a bit above, and I like it when it's being performed by just actors at the top of their game. And I do like that sort of line between sinister and comedic. And I just think Doctor Who, when it does that well, it can sort of tip in either direction really badly. And we could probably think of loads of examples of that, probably even in this season. But there, I just think it's so brilliantly done. So yeah, Tabby and Tilda, my last reason to recommend Paradise Towers. My God, we did it. We did it. Well, in fact, I think we talked double the length of the story. So people are definitely getting their value
Yeah,
here.
you might. Are you going to edit some of it out?
Don't you behave yourself. I won't take out a single word, not
Okay.
one syllable. Not one line. However, whilst we're still in the episode, I'm just going to ask quickly, are you willing to come back for a second?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And should we go to the Sontaran experiment next?
Yes, I
Then,
would dearly love to do that one because it's one I enjoy, and
whilst we're talking about that, then we'll springboard and choose the third. Oh man, that cliffhanger in the Sontaran experiment. He comes out the ship and goes, ah.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's marvelous, isn't it? Well, look, just leads me to thank you very much for your time and for just for talking for choosing such an idiosyncratic story with loads of strengths, some weaknesses. It's just such an interesting chat.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Really. Until next time.
Yeah.